Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The Inflation Reduction Act is gushing about $30,000 per EV at the EV market, and they're still losing money. So if you do the spread, you're talking about something like $100,000 cost to society. This is unsustainable.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Mark P. Mills, Executive Director at the National Center for Energy Analytics. He was also on campus as part of our CCA lecture series. We'll talk later about the economics and future of electric vehicles. First, we're joined by Molly Hemingway. She is Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Editor-in-Chief at The Federalist, and a Fox News contributor. Molly, very nice to see you again.
Great to be here with you.
Thank you for joining us. We have not talked since the election, in fact, since before the election in November, so we've got any number of topics we can discuss. I wanted to begin by asking you about how we've seen Democrats and the left react to these first few weeks of the Trump administration, and they seem to have locked on to a pair of attacks. One is a constitutional crisis. Donald Trump is causing a constitutional crisis. And the other is the idea that he wants to turn the country into an oligarchy, ruled by the rich, and Elon Musk is taking his power, and Elon Musk is running roughshod over the federal government. Why do you think that those two lines of attack are the ones that have been landed on by the left as their sort of opening salvo against the new Trump administration?
I'm not sure I have any insight into why they chose those lines of attack. I think we need to be open to the possibility that they're not very good at coming up with lines of attack right now. Usually, Democrats are actually pretty good at coming up with messages that resonate well with the media and that push their agenda forward. But we saw this during the campaign when they talked about how Donald Trump would be a threat to democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it never really made sense. They said, if Donald Trump's elected democratically, then he will be a threat to democracy. And someone had pointed out that if you instead replace the word democracy with bureaucracy, it made a lot of sense. Donald Trump will be a threat to bureaucracy. It's actually true. He is a threat to the bureaucracy. And you're seeing that with some of this messaging as well that's coming out. So the constitutional crisis, on the one hand, I think it's just inappropriate to talk about a constitutional crisis when there isn't one. But it's also true that the particular approach taken by Democrats to challenge certain actions by this administration, that's to go to regional courts, regional federal courts, and get nationwide injunctions. And there is an aspect of a nationwide injunction by a single judge on a regional court, purporting to be above the literal president of the United States. There is a way that if that were upheld, that would be a constitutional crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But even Trump doesn't seem to think that is. He says, okay, well, we've got these sort of rogue judges trying to stop me, and I will work through the courts to have that taken care of. And that, by the way, probably will be taken care of because you've had multiple justices on the Supreme Court say for the last several years, we have got to deal with this nationwide injunction issue.
The beginning of the Trump administration, I can't recall if I may have talked to you about this, so stop me, I guess, if we have. It's such a different feel than the first term of Donald Trump because after the first election, people did not necessarily expect he was going to win. And so everyone was prepared in different ways. And you had these recriminations after the election. You didn't believe we'd win and we did. And there are going to be punishments or, right, you can't be in the club anymore. There's all sorts of, like, it was just a very weird feeling for a while after that first election. This time, in pockets, certainly, but everyone was pulling on the same side of the rope for the most part in the party. And so it feels to me like this, these first weeks of the Trump administration are so much more joyful. They've been, Trump has been given an assignment by the American people, and he is going about it in a meticulous way to carry things out and do it as big and as bold and as quickly as possible. And there's just, you know, the left tries to paint it as some sort of dark, as you said, democratic crisis, and all, but there's a lot of joy in the Trump administration and inside the White House right now.
We're certainly hearing a lot of that, particularly from across the country. People excited that things that they had been told would be done for decades are actually getting done. But what I think is interesting about the comparison to the first Trump administration, it was enabled in part by him not winning the popular vote, that you saw a broad, massive resistance. And that was a that was coordinated by Democrat groups and whatnot. But you had a resistance within each agency. They were very proud of it. They said, we are the EPA in resistance, or we are the Defense Department in resistance. So they were openly bragging about how they were not subject to constitutional authority. And I think the hysteria surrounding that moment made for a lot of old school Republicans to also be scared about it and kind of join with those people. Well, that's just been so utterly rebuked by the voters themselves. And Trump was very clear. If I win, I'm going to put Elon Musk in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency. We're going to do audits. And people liked it. And so when he's doing it, it's hard to gin up hysteria when people are saying, well, that's why we voted for him in part, you know.
Molly Hemingway with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE. Just last week, Elon Musk had about 2.5 perfect minutes of describing why what he was doing and what his department was doing was so important for right now and for the future of the country and for the future of democracy. So he said, this is about returning democracy to the people. And he used this, not even a metaphor really, but said, this is the closure of the feedback loop. Voters vote and then things happen. Voters vote and then there is a reaction to that process happening, and that the Department of Government Efficiency is part of that. Did you like that as much as I did?
Well, it's one of these things that you were just saying, you know, people being joyful. If you're affiliated with Hillsdale College, or you've been learning, you know, if you're an alum or you've been learning from the professors here, we've been talking about the administrative state for a very long time, and our professors have written books about this. And to have it being talked about in very friendly for normal audiences, you know, by Elon Musk, one of the most powerful men in the world. And, you know, Trump talked about the administrative state somewhat in the first term, but actually taking it on, it is what people have been desperate for decades. Yes, they kept seeing that they would put all this effort into voting and nothing would change. And it happened over and over again to the point that I think it was threatening the republic. We are a self-governed people. We do believe government is of, by, and for the people. And yet because of this unaccountable, unelected administrative state that was judge, jury, and executioner that we had no ability to control, it you know, it's threatening the republic itself. And so it's funny to watch Elon Musk come to this realization in real time. One thing I would like for him to realize is this was always the progressive model. The progressives deeply believed that the people could not be trusted to govern, and so they wanted to put in experts. They were kind of open and honest about that. Woodrow Wilson was very open about it. And so we're just seeing this kind of come to fruition. But this, the whole reason there's a problem is because it was intended to be this problem.
It's incredible, as you allude to, the conversations that we've had or that people around Hillsdale have had about the administrative state and being told, no, you're imagining things, it doesn't exist. And again, in these weeks since Donald Trump has taken office, everyone essentially on the left is acknowledging everything that has been said is correct. There is an entrenched bureaucracy that operates, that believes it has can act with impunity and has job security forever. There is a fourth branch of government, unelected, unaccountable. The ACLU in their statement essentially said as much, that these career civil servants have always been a check against the executive branch, as if they're not a part of the executive branch. And admitting, too, that they trust these longtime government employees more than they trust the will of the people. They would rather have the government employees make decisions and chart the path of the country than the president elected by the rest of the country. It's just incredible to hear them speak in this way.
Wait, they're having to acknowledge what they have been pushing for a long time. You see this even with debates about whether there can be independent agencies, as they're called. So the media will say, oh, Donald Trump wants to take control over independent agencies. Independent from whom? You know, in a constitutional republic like ours, you're never independent from the people. And that's what they want to be independent from. Like a dictator is independent. If you're an independent agency that nobody has oversight of, that's dictatorial. It's just not... It's not something that we provide for in our constitutional form of governance.
Molly Hemingway with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I want to come back in a minute and ask a little more about the relationship between Donald Trump and Elon Musk.
Welcome to the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and I've been reading this fantastic book recently. Of course, all my friends need to know about this, but when I'm writing down the title of the book, should I underline it, italicize it, put it in quotes, or do something else entirely? Well, it depends on what you're using to do the writing and whose opinion you value. If you're typing, you should generally italicize book titles, unless you're a big Associated Press fan. This style guide recommends using quotes for book titles. I don't love this personally because it loses the distinction between short and long works such as essays and books. But one thing's for sure, if you're handwriting, you should underline book titles simply because that's easier to write and read than handwritten italics. That's your Grammar Minute. Visit thegrammarminute.com for more tips and tricks.
Hi, I'm Jordan, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the legislative vesting clause of the Constitution.
Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution states, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States." To the founders, legislative power was the power to make laws that apply to all alike that are clear and easy to understand. The Constitution says all legislative powers, and that means Congress cannot rightfully delegate these powers to some other body. Today our laws are thousands of pages long. Sometimes rules are tens of thousands, and no one can read them. Congress has abdicated its legislative power to unelected bureaucrats and countless executive agencies. This is a violation of Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket Constitution and Declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
You're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. As of October 1, 1942, according to Kentucky Law Code, anyone who handles a reptile in a religious service can be fined anywhere between $50 and $100. Even with this deterrent in place, snake handling during Pentecostal church services remains as a practice in Kentucky's countrysides. Rattlesnakes tend to be the snake of choice, and as one would imagine, the practice can be dangerous, with multiple deaths having been reported due to these services. Additionally, members of these churches often refuse medical treatment in the instance of a bite for religious reasons. Kentucky is not alone in having these snake-handling churches. The first recording of this practice was in Tennessee, and spread throughout Appalachia and beyond, even reaching Los Angeles, California. Snake-handling churches derive from multiple verses in the Bible, including a literal reading from a passage in the Gospel of Mark, which says, "They shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." Coming out of the Pentecostal movement, which is a form of evangelical Protestantism, participants wish to feel a close connection to God. Members of these churches have claimed that those who have gotten bitten have handled the snake before it was spiritually ready. Services can also include speaking in tongues and other characteristics of Pentecostal churches. This particular law is rarely truly enforced, so much so that there have been several attempts at shows and documentaries following these churches. Reptiles and snakes are legal to own, and police have said in the past that they will not charge anyone unless a child becomes involved. So, next time you're in Kentucky, be wary of rattlesnakes, lest you have a spiritual experience and find yourself having to pay for it. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more of Letter of the Law or other student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You'll find older episodes of this show, plus all the fantastic Hillsdale College audio we have available, including The Larry Arn Show, Imprimis, the Hillsdale College Online Courses Podcast, and Hillsdale Dialogues. Find them all at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Molly Hemingway is with us. She is Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Editor-in-Chief at The Federalist, and Fox News Contributor. We were talking a bit about the Department of Government Efficiency and the role of Elon Musk in the new administration, which you rightfully point out is a role that was promised by Donald Trump on the campaign trail. People knew about it and said, yes, we want this, and now it's being carried out. The media has tried to poke at this a bit already, and I guess I'm at least curious about how this relationship between the president and Elon Musk moves forward. You have two men who are used to having their own way, two men who are very comfortable being the alpha, being the person in charge, being the person making decisions. And you're already here, again, the media sort of poking and saying, hey, Elon Musk has Donald Trump's power. What do you think about him being on the cover of Time magazine? Do you get the sense that this relationship is, we're talking about a husband and wife, is it built for the long term? Can they coexist deep into the future?
Well, I don't know if they want to build it for the long term. Elon Musk has said he wants to have a very short period of time to do this audit and then be done with it. And Donald Trump is president for the next 4 years. So they undoubtedly have this close relationship. Elon Musk, when he puts his mind to something, is amazing. This is a guy who's built multiple billion-dollar companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's done so much more in life than most of us will ever do. He's clearly a great man, you know, and Donald Trump is clearly a great man when you think of great men through history. So it's kind of interesting that they're working together. It's something we haven't seen a ton of, but I don't think they want, Elon Musk doesn't want to be a permanent federal employee. He wants to save the country. I think in his mind, he wants to get to Mars. I mean, he wants to do really great space travel, and he knows that the United States, his country, is the, you know, the country he wants to do that from, and our federal government is so sclerotic and awful and overregulated and all these things. He understands he can't get there unless he helps fix these problems. So, but I think he wants to do it quickly, just like at Twitter, which he, you know, bought and turned into X. It was kind of a quick operation.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of discussion, certainly in the campaign and since the campaign, about the common sense that President Trump has on what are called these 80-20 issues, right? Where the president is able to look and say something as simple as, okay, well, paper straws stink. We're going to bring back plastic straws. Or, you know, you like cooking with natural gas? Okay, you can keep doing that. We're not going to ban natural gas stoves from your house. And there are a number of issues. Are these 80-20 type issues enough to keep his popularity where it is right now, which is the highest he has had since becoming a presidential candidate or being president?
His popularity is very high, but this could change for any number of reasons, including that he really did get a pretty weak economy at the start of his term. And even with some of his proposals that worked so well during his first term, such as getting rid of regulations before you enact new ones, or just closing out the regulatory process, meaning making a decision when someone's up for regulatory review. A lot of companies just want to know yes or no so they can move on. And he really emphasizes being quick about stuff like that. That really does, stuff like that helps with the economy. Continuing tax cuts will help with the economy. But we have really bad inflation, and that could affect his approval. But yeah, he's got the highest ratings he's had in ever. And he won the presidency the first time with really low approval ratings. So they're even more remarkable than they seem, I think. And it is partly this gift. But it's not just, you know, the 80-20 hot button cultural issues. It's just being able to look at all sorts of even big things like DOGE, like government efficiency, like how we fight wars and whether we were doing a good job with that. The American people are generally supportive of a lot of these views. The Washington, D.C. wasn't, and it's Washington, D.C. that's kind of getting defeated here.
As you see media coverage of these first weeks of the Trump administration, do you get the sense that any lessons have been learned from the way that most of the media covered the first Trump administration?
I genuinely do not think the media have changed that much, but it almost doesn't matter as much as the fact that the view of the media is regarded so much less. People just don't care what the media are saying in a way that they care deeply in the first administration. So right after he wins the first time, the media tell everyone that Donald Trump is secretly a Russian spy who was colluding with Russia to steal the election. And a lot of people believed it. And now they have so overdone everything and supported every conspiracy theory and been made out to be laughingstocks that even though they haven't learned anything, they're not able to create these mobs of hysteria like they were before.
What do you make about the new media seats in the White House briefing room, the rearranging, and who's called on, who's not called on, who's in the room, who's not in the room? Is the White House aware that there are new, different ways, perhaps learning from the election, to both reach and influence Americans and voters across the country?
What we've seen thus far is already very promising, opening up to new media, which is just common sense. A lot of people were not swayed by CBS News, but they were swayed by various podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't those podcasters be able to ask questions on behalf of their listeners, and wouldn't they ask much better questions? So some of the changes that have been made are already good, but the White House Correspondents Association really controls a lot about who sits where, who's in the pool, who gets called on first, who gets called on last. That is a completely corrupt organization that needs to be replaced. So if I were the Trump team, I would open up a bid for a new White House Correspondents Association. Some of what they do is good, like managing pool operations. Mm-hmm. What that means is which reporters accompany the president for which trip or throughout the day. Someone could do that who's not as cartoonishly biased as the White House Correspondents Association.
I wanted to talk about something I find just delightful, which is the presence once again in various locations, including the Oval Office and elsewhere, of children, young children, on the shoulders of Elon Musk, young children exiting the plane with Vice President Vance and his family as they land in Europe. It is delightful to see young children around and people accepting young children around in some of the most important places in Washington.
Well, the press conference that Trump and Elon Musk did was also done with Little X,
mm-hmm.
One of Elon's children, particularly in the case of Vice President Vance, who is in an intact family, who is married to the mother of his children. Seeing that family traveling and seeing the kids being normal and seeing how much love the parents have for them and just what real parents they are, it is wonderful to see, and I think it's a great example for young men to see, you know, just what being a man is all about, including having a happy, healthy family that you provide for.
Ali Hemingway is Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale College, Editor-in-Chief at The Federalist, and Fox News contributor. Molly Hemingway, always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Mark P. Mills, Executive Director of the National Center for Energy Analytics. We talk about the economics and future of electric vehicles. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, I'm Joshua Palladino, a PhD candidate at Hillsdale College. Here's master's student Theodore Madrid with a message from Thomas Jefferson on the role of the federal and state governments under the Constitution.
In a letter to Judge William Johnson, Thomas Jefferson said, "I believe the states can best govern our home concerns, the general government our foreign ones. I wish, therefore, to see maintained that wholesome distribution of powers established by the Constitution for the limitation of both, and never to see all offices transferred to Washington, where further withdrawn from the eyes of the people, they may more secretly be bought and sold as at market."
Hillsdale College, Pursuing Truth, Defending Liberty, since 1844.
You're listening to What's in a Name. So this particular Michigan city's name at first look has a fairly simple origin story. It's a bit more complicated than it first seems. The name Detroit comes from a French word that means straight, like a body of water, which, in turn, comes from the city's positioning around the Detroit River. The river comes from Lake Erie, one of the five Great Lakes. The city still remains as one of the oldest and most important cities in the Midwest. So the name comes from French settlements in the early 18th century, which was roughly 300 years ago. The land itself has been populated for over 11,000 years by many different peoples, including the Iroquois and the Hurons. Rich in resources, it was highly contested, and after many battles, ultimately ended up within the United States, first as a territory, and then as part of the state of Michigan. It has since earned the nickname of the Motor City due to its history with Henry Ford. This has been What's in a Name. My name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Whether you've just started teaching or spent decades in the classroom, you know there's always more to learn. But where do you start? Well, here at Hillsdale College, we have the answer for you. Tried and True, a primer on sound pedagogy by Hillsdale College professor Daniel Copeland. In this little book, you'll read lessons from more than 25 years of Dr. Copeland's classroom experience. It's all distilled into 14 easy-to-read chapters on lesson planning, assignments, and classroom management. And it will help you improve your skills and inspire you as a teacher, one of our most important professions. Whether you've been in front of the classroom for years, or this is your first year, when you read Tried and True, you'll find something to help you keep improving every single day. You don't need to go at it alone. Let Dr. Copeland's real-world experience encourage you and inspire you. You can get your copy today at hillsdale.edu/true. That's hillsdale.edu/true.
Welcome to the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and I'm here to talk about ChatGPT. I'm a writer of both news and fiction by trade, so I'm in one of the jobs people think ChatGPT could eliminate. So, am I worried? The answer is no, and the reason is that grammar isn't everything. I know that's a weird thing for me to say, but it's true. Good grammar alone doesn't make for good writing, and even though ChatGPT has generally correct grammar and constructs pieces that wouldn't get too many marks in red pen, it's still currently unable to generate anything resembling written art. So here's the question. How can writers stay ahead of ChatGPT? The answer is write like a human. Be expressive. Use good grammar, of course, but also go beyond the grammar into style and tone and voice. Learn to be yourself in your writing and cultivate yourself into the kind of writer people will want to read. That's your Grammar Minute.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow us on X. We're at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. We're joined by Mark P. Mills from the National Center for Energy Analytics. He's also on campus here at Hillsdale College, part of our CCA lecture series on economic issues and controversies, talking about the economics and future of electric vehicles. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
We'll talk about the future in a bit. Talk about the present. We've been told for many years that EV is the future. How far away is that in terms of what's the adoption rate right now? How have Americans warmed? Have they warmed at all to electric vehicles? What's the present state look like?
Well, it depends on your income. Turns out, unsurprisingly, EVs utterly dominate the luxury car class. Elon Musk himself sells about one-fifth of all luxury cars in the United States. So you can see why the car makers are eager to compete in that very lucrative class of vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Insofar as all cars are concerned, we have both in the United States and in Europe this year, the growth rate in sales has collapsed 20%. And you'd say, well, what's going on? Well, in Germany, they removed the subsidies. In the United States, there's still subsidies, and they're actually expanding. But, you know, people are trying them out, and they're not finding them exactly what they wanted. There's sort of a fundamental category error problem in the language around all of this. EVs are not a revolution in the sense of mobility.
Mm-hmm.
They are extremely interesting. Tesla is actually a spectacular automobile, driven one. Any EV is fun acceleration. But it's a different way of propelling a car. It's still a car. So you change the fuel and propulsion system for a car, it's meaningful, no question about it. And it creates some options which are intriguing, but it's still a car. Wheels, you know, tires, windows, infotainment, and whether or not you make it a fun car to drive or not is a feature that people really care about. People buy cars for personal transportation, mm-hmm. of course, but auto dealers know, and everybody who owns a car, other than those who have no choice but to buy the absolute cheapest car they can when they first start buying and don't have any money. All car purchases are sort of emotional, personal things. That's mm-hmm. why there are literally 1,000 models of car. Why would you, if it's just transportation, they'd all be the same box, and the only difference would be there'd be three kinds, a really big one, a mid-size, and a small one, right? Three kinds of Coke, small, medium, large, three kinds of lattes. No, it's one of the most interesting, freedom-enabling, profound economic inventions in the history of civilization, the automobile, the automobility, the freedoms and the economic options that gives to citizens everywhere is profound, which is why people care about cars.
Mark P. Mills with us talking about the economics and future of electric vehicles. If we move farther down the road, no pun intended, of electric vehicles.
Oh, maybe it was intended.
Maybe. We have to talk about the electric grid and mm-hmm. the power structure because yeah. this is where the cars get their electricity.
Yeah.
Are we anywhere near having an adequate grid to handle the number of electric cars that some people want to see on the road in the next decade or so?
Yeah. Well, it's an easy answer. No. Not close. But let me step back a second. There are millions of electric cars in the United States, and I think if I were guessing the future, there's probably going to be 30 million EVs in America, you know, roughly 10 times where we are today, 6 times where we are today. That's a lot of EVs that you want. If you're a car producer, you want to participate in that new business.
Mm-hmm.
But there are more registered vehicles in America than registered drivers. There's sort of 200 million roughly vehicles in the United States, light duty vehicles, cars and SUVs. So it's a very significant market, but it's not all cars. So what the EV transitionists, they want to transition to EVs, but these transitionists imagine, to your point, is that most cars will be EVs, or eventually all in the near future. In fact, 12 states, following California, will make it illegal for you to purchase anything other than an EV in a half dozen years from now, which, by the way, will affect the cost of cars in about a year
mm-hmm.
because of the length of time for the new model cycles. So could you do that? Well, not easily, because what you're doing is you have to move roughly the same amount of energy to markets that we now use for gasoline. And gasoline, of course, moves in pipes, trucks, and stored in tanks. Electricity, self-evidently, moves in wires and through transformers. It's an odd thing because you can look at gasoline and you can see it in a tank, and you can't see electricity. So you'd think, gee, that's got to be easy to move around. Well, in the bizarre world of the physics of energy, it's 5 to 10 times more expensive to move a unit of energy in electrical terms than in liquid terms.
Mm-hmm.
So the infrastructure required, the physical cost of the infrastructure to move the same amount of energy as we now send to markets for gasoline. If we were to flip a light switch, to use the obvious expression, and all cars were electrical, we would have had to have built about $3 trillion of new infrastructure to deliver the electricity.
Mm-hmm.
That's not counting the chargers, the fuel pumps, and it's not counting the power plants that need to make the energy. I'm just talking about everything in between the power plant and you plugging the vehicle in. This is an astonishing amount of money. It's not in the plans. The assumption is that utilities will just build it, and they could, because they just recover it from you and me mm-hmm. in rates. So it means electric rates will go up by a lot, because $3 trillion is a lot of money. It would essentially triple the build rate that's underway now in the electric infrastructure industry And it's worth noting that much of the hardware that's needed at that scale is not available.
Mm-hmm.
It just simply isn't produced at those scales. Much of it isn't here. 50 to 80% of the world supply for the key components and materials to make batteries for cars come from China.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something you can change overnight, because these are big industries that take years to build and build supply chains for. So the money being thrown at those industries today, you know, it'll do something, but it's not going to delink us from China, and nobody who's serious believes it will.
Hmm. Those batteries that you speak of with the rare earth metals that largely come from China, how long do they last? Do we know how long they last? What are the replacement costs?
Yeah.
Where do those batteries go when they're of no use anymore?
Well, the well-engineered ones last a long time. They probably will last pretty close to the life of the vehicle. Many of them are warrantied for the life of over 10 years. And I would say the batteries that Tesla has designed, his Elon Musk's team, are really spectacular. Only recently have a couple of the world's automakers caught up to Elon Musk's technical quality and design capacities for large car batteries.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll last a decade. I mean, they're like all machines. There will be some that won't last as long, but and maybe much longer, maybe two decades. But eventually they wear out because they're a machine. It's an electrochemical machine instead of a physical, a mechanical machine. But chemistry stuff wears out too. So what do you do with it? Well, right now it's going to go into landfill because they're very, very difficult and hard to, quote, recycle. These are 1,000-pound, to give a sort of a sense, it's not a tank full of goo, right? It's not like a gasoline tank. it's a complicated 1,000-pound electrochemical machine with thousands of cells in it, with cooling systems and power electronics control systems. It's made from aluminum and nickel and cobalt, graphite and manganese. And so lithium is the smallest quantity of metals in it, ironically, in a lithium battery. And copper, aluminum, and other metals are more common. And it's an electrical thing, so it's chemically hazardous to handle. Be careful. It's electrically active.
Mm-hmm.
There's already been very recently in the news really serious fires,
yes,
at facilities that are trying to recycle batteries. You can recycle them. They just cost a lot of money to recycle and have to be handled very, very carefully. But there will be nothing to recycle for at least a decade until they wear out, which means all the new cars that people want to build have to be made from net new materials mined. So this whole thing that we'll solve the material problem for batteries by recycling them, okay, maybe. It's going to be very expensive, but you can't do anything about it for a decade or two.
We will continue our conversation with Mark P. Mills in just a second about the economics and future of electric vehicles. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Welcome to the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and I'm currently waiting on a package from Amazon. If you pictured me standing around in a suit with a fancy tray offering cocktails to my Amazon package, then congratulations. That is, in fact, what I said. To wait on exclusively means to serve. Waitresses wait on you when you're at a restaurant, for example. But if you take too long reading the menu and make your waitress stand there in awkward silence, then she's waiting for you. Waiting on and waiting for are not interchangeable. To recap, to wait on means to serve, accommodate, or look after. To wait for means to kick back and relax until someone else is ready. That's your Grammar Minute. Visit thegrammarminute.com for more tips and tricks.
Hi, I'm Joshua Palladino, a PhD candidate at Hillsdale College. Here's the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Nearly 140 years after the Constitution's adoption, President Calvin Coolidge said, "To live under the American Constitution is the greatest political privilege that was ever accorded to the human race." Hillsdale College, pursuing truth, defending liberty since 1844.
Hey, it's Scott Bertram, and I want to tell you about something new from Hillsdale College. It's the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. Check it out right now. Go to podcast.hillsdale.edu. The Hillsdale College Podcast Network offers free nationwide access to all of Hillsdale's podcast content. That means shows like the Hillsdale Dialogues, the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, the Hillsdale College K-12 Classical Education Podcast, the Larry P. Arnn Show. You can listen wherever you are and whenever you want. And it's always free. Find out more about all of our shows at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You can subscribe to any program with new episodes delivered right to your device. If you want to come close to stepping inside a Hillsdale College classroom, well, the Hillsdale College Podcast Network is for you. Get informed and get entertained at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram, talking with Mark P. Mills from the National Center for Energy Analytics about the economics and future of electric vehicles. Talked about the infrastructure needed to get the power across the country. What about that last step? Those chargers needed to get the power into the vehicles. It's one of the major reasons people cite not being interested, that the range anxiety, they can't find a place to recharge vehicles. Charging stations, what kind of investment would be needed to get a charging network where people would feel comfortable? Is that all through the government to set that up? Right now we have private gas stations all over the place. Are we also, we've been replacing sort of a large portion of the economy by pushing out private interests who run gas stations in favor of government-run charging stations.
Yeah, we certainly didn't have to have government-mandated gasoline stations in the dawn of the automotive age. And in fact, you don't need them now. Elon Musk built the biggest charging network. He didn't get a dime of subsidies for it. So good on him. And everybody's trying to copy him now using subsidies. If I were him, I'd be kind of annoyed. And maybe the evidence was he was or is. Who knows? Look, the charging, we have a misnomer that's been put out there that there's range anxiety. There isn't range anxiety. The EVs that you can buy today have the same range as a gasoline car. It's really easy to get an EV with 300 or 400 miles range. That's what they have. So people want, you can buy them. So where's the anxiety? So obviously this is the phrase that is being used, but it's a misleading phrase. What people are anxious about is the fact that they can refuel easily and conveniently when they need to. And as fast as they're accustomed to. So the when they need to is easy to solve. It's merely money, right? So the government will spend money and make sure there's lots of charging stations. Okay. Sounds easy. Harder than you think. Because first of all, these are electrical charging stations. And when you put lots of high powered, fast electrical charging stations in one place, as we put lots of gasoline pumps in one place, you create a power demand that's really quite remarkable. So we're back to electrical engineering, but not to bore people. But here's the difference. A typical on-the-highway fuel station you go to today with, call it a dozen fuel pumps, and it has like a 7-Eleven or a Sheetz or something there. That whole thing has an electrical demand of roughly a 7-Eleven or a Sheetz.
Mm-hmm.
Lights and little pumps and move the gasoline. To replicate that with electrical refueling, I have to put in high-powered rechargers because the high-power one gets you the speed.
Right.
But you could charge your car overnight inexpensively at low power with what amounts to a closed dryer level of power. And it takes about 8 hours. Big deal. You have three cars. You plug in at night. But on the road, that's a 2-kilowatt charger in number terms in your house. What you need is these several hundred kilowatt chargers that can recharge your vehicle in, say 20 minutes, give or take. Might take 30, but it's that kind of range. And keep in mind, it takes about 4 minutes to fill a gasoline tank. So maybe you're slow, it takes you five. But that's the kind of range. So it takes four or five times longer per filling station. So to service the same number of people, you need four times more filling points. Each charger costs about four to five times more than a gasoline pump. So now we've increased the infrastructure cost 16-fold. I need more land for all those things. And the power itself has an infrastructure requirement that starts to rise to a ballpark, a stadium. So instead of a 7-Eleven worth of electric demand on the highway, I have a stadium's worth of electric demand. You can count the number of fuel stations on a highway. So now think of those as stadiums each time of electric demand. So that's where the money comes in. The convenience problem is still very real.
Should we be worried here in Michigan, meaning cold weather climates? How do electric vehicles adapt to the colder weather, to the snow, to the ice, to the need for to pump heat into the cabin?
Yeah, well, the question answers itself, doesn't it? So the interesting about internal combustion engines is it produces waste heat. You get to scavenge the heat to heat the cabin. So, but it doesn't produce cool air, but now there's an electric car. Electric cars need to generate cool air, so the regular cars. So there's a lot of data on this. Batteries are electrochemical machines. They perform more poorly in cool climates than they do when it's warm. It's just a chemical fact. You can make some batteries that do a little better in cold than others, but they all degrade. So when you run a heater and you take energy away from the battery to heat the cabin, and you have less energy in the battery because the chemistry is less vigorous when it's cold. Roughly speaking, the range of the vehicle, depending on the temperature and how it's driven, drops from 20 to 50%. Mm. So, or put differently, your fuel efficiency gets it's cut in half. Your range is cut in half. Your costs are double in terms of fuel. And there's no easy fix for that. Mm. It just is, it's a non-trivial problem. But again, if you're driving an EV as your second car to work, and your distance to drive is, pick a number. I mean, if you've got a 200-mile range, it becomes 100. You know, most people don't drive 100 miles to work.
Right.
And even if you drove 100 miles to work and it's one way, you can recharge at work, all those things. So there are solutions for niches. But again, we're talking niches as opposed to the mandates are dictated that everybody's going to have to drive an EV. It's a really bad idea in northern climates. I'm Canadian. I grew up in much colder climate than Michigan. Michigan is the deep south.
You all live. Me.
Yeah, you guys are in the south. My family's from northern Manitoba. You want cold? That's cold. But, you know, you can use them in the summer there, and you can use them episodically in the winter. And, you know, they're heavier because the battery is so heavy. That helps in snow traction, so that's a plus.
One final question for Mark P. Mills from the National Center for Energy Analytics, talking about the economics and future of electric vehicles. If the administration, as it appears to be, will be less friendly toward the electric vehicle market, toward the idea of subsidies or incentives, what effect do you think, crystal ball, it will have on whatever momentum the EV market has here in the U.S.?
Well, it's been losing momentum naturally because the artificial push is not sustainable. So that's why we already see sales down, and Ford and GM, Volkswagen in Europe, already backing off their pledges and their plans to go all electric rapidly. So, and that's because they're burning through money and losing money. Elon Musk spent a decade perfecting a supply chain, construction capabilities to make a niche product, and you can't catch up to him in a year or so, even with government throwing money at you.
Well, I mean, Ford has to slow the sales of the F-150 Lightning because they lose $60,000 on every, so they sell more, they lose more money.
And even with that, the Inflation Reduction Act is gushing about $30,000 per EV at the EV market, and they're still losing money. So if you do the spread, you're talking about something like $100,000 cost to society. This is unsustainable. I think it's not just the tone that's going to change. His tone's obviously already changed. Rolling back silly things, some of them are easy by just fiat declaration, you know, presidential order. Some of them are going to be very hard because they're already enshrined in law, or they've been regulations have been duly passed that have to be reversed. So I think it's going to be difficult to push some stuff back. I think a lot of it will be and should be pushed back. And Elon Musk himself has said for years, he said it recently, that he's happy to compete in a non-subsidized market, selling his cars to people. You know, the subsidy part of it is competing against what? I mean, what if you're worried about China producing cheap EVs, and they do, and they're extremely heavily subsidized, their subsidies are really marbled into their system. And, you know, Trump has a point on this, is that you don't know how you can identify the specific subsidies that generate a cheap EV in China. They didn't invent a different EV. They didn't invent new chemistry. They don't have different kind of batteries. Theirs are cheaper because they've done something that's a Nobel Prize worthy. They've subsidized the hell out of them, excuse the French. They're up and down the system. So legitimately, you could look at that class of market and say, you know, we're just going to slap 100% tariff to match your 100% subsidy. And Rivian, you can compete against the Chinese EVs. I mean, Reagan did that with the some people have forgotten, with motorcycles to convince the Japanese to build cars here, not motorcycles. And it worked. Mm. So, you know, targeted tariffs have efficacy, and even our favorite, well, that's my favorite because I worked for him as a child. Even our favorite president of days of yore used the tariff tool as a political cudgel.
Yeah. Mark P. Mills, National Center for Energy Analytics. He's here on campus, part of our CCA lecture series on economic issues and controversies, speaking on the economics and future of electric vehicles. Mark, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great to be here at the Great Hillsdale. Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Molly Hemingway, Senior Journalism Fellow here at Hillsdale College, and Mark P. Mills. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
To the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and today we're going to talk about one of my favorite grammatical mistakes, dangling modifiers. Consider the sentence, exhausted after school, even coffee couldn't keep me awake. You probably know exactly what I mean, so at least it's clear, but it's also pretty grammatically wonky. That long modifier at the beginning of the sentence, exhausted after school, is clearly supposed to be modifying I, but it actually modifies the subject coffee, which, if you think about it, doesn't make any sense. Can coffee even get tired? The key here is to remember that when you have a dangling modifier at the beginning of a sentence, it will usually modify the subject of the following clause. So you could reword this to say, exhausted after school, I couldn't stay awake, even after drinking a huge cup of coffee. And that would be correct. That's your Grammar Minute.
Court is in session with Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Hello, my name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM, where I tell you all about the world's wackiest laws that are still on the books. Washington State is known for its lush forests, the city of Seattle, and, apparently, Bigfoot sightings. Skamania County in Washington has decided to take the supposed presence of Bigfoot seriously by passing an ordinance in 1984 that banned the hunting and killing of Bigfoot, with the punishment of an up to $1,000 fine and possible jail time. This is not the first ordinance to help protect the life of Bigfoot. An initial ordinance was passed in 1969 that made it illegal to hunt Sasquatch, with a much more severe punishment of an up to $10,000 fine and up to 5 years in jail. In 1984, the City Council revisited the ordinance and decided to revise it. The decision followed an increase in activity in the area surrounding the search for Sasquatch. People were coming from all over to hunt the cryptid, causing some disturbance to locals. As a response, the county decided to make Skamania an official refuge for Bigfoot, especially since Bigfoot is classified as an endangered species. Don't worry, however, for all of you Bigfoot believers, it is still perfectly legal to go to the area to research and try and find the legend. Just keep it to pictures as proof.
This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale, 101.7 FM.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.